Welcome to The Perspectivalist. Our agenda is to offer a perspective of the world that allows you to think more clearly as a Christian. We want the normativity of scriptures to be the starting point of everything we do. Thanks for joining the conversation. This is the inaugural episode of Season 5 of The Perspectivalist. I am your host, Yuri Brito. One of my great fascinations has been, for the last 20 years, the music of the church. And I'm really privileged to have one of my dearest friends in the world, Jared Ritchie, with me. I'm actually at his office in Monroe, Louisiana, at the Church of the Redeemer, and we are awaiting the beginning of the Christendom Lectures 2024, which will commence this evening. So, Jared, welcome.
Well, thanks, Yuri. Welcome to my piece of the world.
Yeah, it's good to be here into the Louisiana Holy Land. I've told many people, and I want to say this just very sincerely, that apart from Taylor Swift, you are one of my favorite musicians ever.
Oh man, such good company.
You are in great company. I don't know when your worldwide tour is going to begin, but I count you as one of the finest musicians I know. I want to talk about church music. I have with me here a couple of books you have written or contributed to, Bach to the Future, Fostering Music Literacy Today. And then you've contributed to Raise the Song, a classical Christian guide to music education. You have a lot of ongoing projects. Jared, do you remember when you began to have this musical stirring about church music? Do you remember that experience?
Yes. I mean, I've been in the CREC since 2005. And, you know, college and training and music, it was kind of marinating around that time, and then 06, 07, 08, just really seeing, hey, there's a wealth of good music out there, and the church historically has been the vibrant stewards of good music and art, and it didn't seem to me from my growing up that that was something that was on the evangelical radar. And even in the Reformed world, I think there's more of a bent towards it, but I don't think that we are as equipped to do it. So we're kind of just fumbling our way in the dark. So that's kind of where it started for me, was, you know, wondering, how can we do this better? How can we make the world envious through our music in the right way?
And there is certainly a sense that evangelicals think that music itself doesn't convey theology or the gravitas of biblical history. And the idea seems to be that music functions very experiential, if not existential, sentimental feelings, and that has been the preeminence of evangelical music. What has happened in the American scene that has sort of fostered this distaste for robust hymnody?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a couple ways you could answer that. First of all, I mean, the revivalistic Charles Finney theological bent, the Enlightenment came on the scene in the 1700s and really changed the perspective of Christians seeing music and worship cosmically, and then they moved to seeing it humanistically.
Yeah.
And so downstream from that, several hundred years, you have individualism and emotionalism run amok. So that's one side of the equation. But a very real side that my sleeves are rolled up in is the music literacy side. I mean, there is no way to be musically mature if you cannot engage or have no musical muscles to pick up something that's good musically. It would be like not having taste buds. You can't enjoy ahi tuna or a fine steak or a one bacon wrapped, you know, duck fat fries or any other kind of delicacy that we love in the South here. If you have no palate for that, then it's moot to even talk about maturity in it. If you don't have the ability to make music, then there is no real progress to be had in maturity of music. So part of the issue is a bad theology, a very modernistic theology, but a real part of the issue and the area to which we need to correct is serious training in music again, like a language, like we have been doing so well since the Reformation, recovering a biblical literacy. We've seen that. We've got to see that in sung literacy as well.
I think I told you this before, but I was going for a walk with our old mutual friend, James Jordan, I think back 2011. And I made a statement in my young pastorate to the point of something, the sense of, I don't think, Jim, that we can grow in our musical literacy. I just don't think we can get there. We need to be somewhat satisfied with where we are. And I think it was among the many rebukes he gave me, that was one of the biggest ones. He said, of course we can, but we got to begin when our children are young so that this becomes the normal vocabulary that they breathe rather than something foreign. And you have worked a lot. In fact, you came to our congregation some months ago and trained little young musicians, and they did a piece as a prelude on Sunday morning. And I told the congregation afterwards, this is what he accomplished in a couple of hours. Imagine if these children were given to the task of learning music as essential to the flourishing of human nature. So talk a little about what can parents do to think more clearly about music for their children, and perhaps begin discussing a bit why have the evangelical community, our community, the community that we breathe, so despised musical literacy, choosing instead to offer words without music?
Yeah, well, that's a big one. I mean, it does touch on the bad theology that I alluded to earlier, of course, the theology that says, I think a theology that is informed by a lack of musical training. So that theology says that you have truth over here, you have goodness and ethics over here, and beauty over there. And music helps you harmonize in a real way. It helps you see multiple layers. Well, all art does that, really. All art stacks this level of meaning, that level of meaning. And so parents and theologians, when you're not trained in music, you see it as extra, you see it as frilly, you see it as garnish on the plate and not the meat or the protein that it is. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is, you also rationalize your ignorance.
Yeah.
So for generations, people don't think they need to learn music. Well, then you start to justify that ignorance by saying, well, we don't really need to do anything with it. It's not really that important, but it's really foundational. I don't think there is an overdoing of that, especially where we are in the history of the church. We can't afford to minimize music anymore.
Right. And children are the best PR for this kind of thing. Because I think over the years we've had parents come to our congregation and they are just befuddled by a fugue tunes or whatever. And they said, we'll never learn this here. And then 2 weeks later, as I've heard this testimony recently, their child is singing in the living room, and it is the easiest persuasion I've ever had happen, and it didn't require much work.
Yeah, it's the shortest rebuke in stature. Rebuke. You know, these little children rebuking their parents, that is where the reforms can come. It's hard to learn music as an adult, we know. Right. I mean, it's hard to learn any language as an adult. Children are the most malleable. I mean, even sitting here for a time through our high school Hebrew class, these students, these juniors and seniors, were just whipping through the Hebrew prepositions and the verbs and the phonograms, and I'm hanging on for dear life, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm 20-something years older than this class, and it was a prescient reminder that my brain, even at almost 40, is not as able to take on a language as even juniors and seniors, not to mention 8-year-olds, 5-year-olds singing. They have such a much more a malleable brain, and they are not cynical. They've not been bathed in this cultural that music is feminine, overly effete, that that they don't need to really, if you want to be a masculine, God-fearing man, you'll pick up a gun or a bow and arrow, but you won't pick up a baton or sit right down at a piano bench or sing and belt out a high B flat in a cantata in a children's choir. So you've got a lot of that working against you. But yeah, I think we have a lot of potential here. There's a lot of encouragement to be had. And the reality is, I think we're due for a pendulum swing, where people will see that enough with this telling us about religion, enough with the gospel language in just the preaching only. Give us the feasting, give us the good life. And I think that is far more persuasive to folks when they see a congregation singing, feasting, and dancing, and bathed in the words of psalms and the scriptures and hymns. They see that life. That is what's going to change the culture far more than a 45-minute podcast sermon will do, and you just happen to hear it in person this week, or maybe you're hearing it on an app, but you don't really value worship. If they see that all of this is the, quote, good life that you and I have talked about before, then I think we're going to continue to see a wonderful revival and reformation, especially given where we are post-COVID. It's like, it's the anti-COVID hysteria, these things.
Yeah, it's probably one of the most countercultural things we do today. I mean, to see young families asking questions of their pastors, say, "Pastor, we want to begin singing at the dinner table. Where do we begin?" Well, there's lots of places to begin, but that is the beginning of a reversal of how people have looked at things. And if that festive mood doesn't begin at the table at home, it's hard for that to overflow into the life of the church as well. It's where the home functions as a little mini training ground, so that when people come on Sunday mornings, they have already been enriched throughout the week, and they join other voices that are prepared. But this is the kind of thing I hear very often as a question. Why do you think at this point of history, it seems to me at least, Jared, that there is a revival of musical literacy? Churches are pondering the question of music much more. They're realizing that what they consider to be this hurdle that they could never overcome, it's actually very doable, and I get questions on a regular basis. What is stirring this revival of music in the United States?
I think about this a good bit of the time, and in one way or another, I think that the music literacy for the church historically has always followed biblical literacy. So it's not a coincidence in my mind that we have such wonderful music of the Baroque period in the likes of Bach and Handel and Vivaldi and other folks downstream from the German Reformation. And a biblical recovery. I mean, Bach's music is saturated in the scriptures. And I think that's the pattern, is you hear the gospel, you learn the scriptures, and from that takes seed and grows artistic retellings of the gospel in story and song and painting and drama and so forth. You're re-echoing the gospel. I think that's why we've seen a revival of some sorts. We've seen our culture, our American culture, as lost as it is, it's just depraved, and people, their eyes are seeing this is shallow. This is wanting evangelicalism that is dressed up as a prosperity gospel, or dressed up as, you know, living your best life now, and all these other things. People are seeing through that. They're seeing we need to go to the scriptures. The COVID hysteria has really, like I said, forced this issue, and that is the blessing of it. It says, okay, you don't want to worship one another? How about staying at home away from other people where you can't shake their hands, you can't hug them, you can't eat a meal with them, you can't sing a Christmas carol to them? That's made folks go, no, we need to be singing together. We need to be Bible studies and book studies, and I love listening groups, and you know, those kinds of things. We got to be doing that together so that we can be really human again.
Yeah, yeah. What men meant for evil, God meant for good. And I think that's what happened during the during and post era of COVID. The people of God said, we realized that there was this massive absence of music in the church. And that only came to our attention when the government told us to stop singing.
Right.
And then we realized that wasn't a hard thing to do because we weren't singing at all. That gave a preeminent attention to the subject of singing. And so as we look at churches in our denomination, the CREC, who places a very big stress on singing corporately, have you seen the CREC sort of leading the way in this musical literacy? Are there other institutions that I'm not aware of who are doing these kinds of things? Or the CREC really, they have skin in the game, right? This is very much a part of the DNA of who we are. If you walk into any of our congregations around the world, including ours in Brazil, Japan, Norway, you're going to see that music is a fundamental element. And those guys, Jared, the guys in Brazil, for example, don't have access to the entire Psalter.
That's right.
Where we have a variation of Psalters here, so much so that there are church denominations splitting over what Psalter to use. That's when you know there's an abundance.
Psalter wars. You don't hear that phrase every day.
No, the great Psalter wars. What do you see in the CREC as you travel around the country? You're always exposed to a lot of CREC churches. Are you seeing this kind of, this rapid movement towards a robust hymnody and Psalter?
Yes, it's kind of like the poet or the novelist Kurt Vonnegut says, you know, if you're a one-eyed man in the kingdom of the blind, you're pretty well off.
Yeah.
In some ways, the CREC is a one-eyed man in the backdrop of a culture that has no eyes. But in another sense, it's a joyful, eyes wide open at the wonder of hymnody and psalmody that has come over the centuries. That is the beauty, as I see, of the CREC as a generic description, is giving thanks for what has come before, not trying to treat church music and worship as something that is novel. What can we bring that is novel to worship? But what can we grab a hold of that our brothers and sisters in the faith have done before well, and can we stand on their shoulders? That thankfulness, that rich heritage of psalms, even and hymns, has done great things for the church. And the CREC, generally speaking, is thankful for what has come before. It seeks to sing what has come before. It doesn't have an ageist approach, but just because something is new, it is bad. But I think more the approach is there is so much good that is in our history. We need to give thanks for that so that we can actually have a trajectory going forward. You can't plot a line without 2 points. Right. If you just have 1 point now, you just have a dot, right?
Right.
You need to see where the church has gone musically and worship-wise, and you need to give thanks for it. And you can't give thanks for it if you don't know what's come before.
Yeah, there seems to be, when you look at these massive musical institutions like Bethel and Hillsong, that there is a lack of gratitude for the history of music in the church. We need to consider that the Holy Spirit is very conservative, and so he has provided 300-400 years of very rich musicality for the church. And when there's a lack of gratitude, what you do is you skip 500 years and you say, I can do better. And it's very obvious that the untrained 20-year-old who's composing his own music for his megachurch has not done better, because we see the transience of this kind of music, right? I wrote an essay that I delivered for the Psalm Tap some years ago, that your standard number one in the music hit lasts shorter than a college degree. Whereas some of the music that we sing goes back to the second and third century. So how do we begin to sort of foster this renewal of interest in music that has gone before us?
Yeah, the main thing I tell folks, churches, my students in the school, when I'm writing posts, I'm thinking of retraining our ears and our minds to see ourselves corporately. Yeah. I know that sounds like just a catchphrase. Corporate worship was a very common term when you and I were growing up. We were going to corporate worship. It's corporate worship, right? We are the body of Christ first and foremost. So we need body songs. We need songs that reinforce the truth of our head, Christ, but also rehearse for one another, singing to one another the truths that are in the scriptures, the truths that are apparent to us, but also the music that we sing, the forms of our hymns should subtly or greatly reinforce that corporate quality. So fuguing tunes are great ways to do this. CREC churches love that.
Yeah.
They're rustic, backwoods country psalmody, as they've been called,
yeah,
but they are lovely for that, you know, angular way to remind us, hey, we're the body of Christ here, imperfect here on this side of the resurrection, but we're rehearsing his goodness in song joyfully, maybe not the most skillfully now,
yeah,
but we're practicing with a goal to be even more glorious in ages to come.
Yeah, great. Jared, a couple of things here as we close.
Sure.
You are invested in, you've been invested in music for a long time, music training, and we have some great hymnals in the CREC. We have the Cantus Christi 2020. We have the Treasure of Psalms and Hymns, published some years ago, which is titanic in nature, probably 1,200 pieces in there. And then you guys are working on something very distinct here for Church of the Redeemer, and it's called the Redeemer Hymnal. Tell us a little bit about this project that I'm very excited about.
Yes. So, you know, I am at first, I'm a music educator and a church music historian, I guess, secondarily, and a choir director. But our Redeemer Hymnal, I'm very thankful for both versions of the Cantus Christi. I'm thankful for the work that's been done there, Duck Schuller and then Michael Owens with the Treasury of Hymns and Psalms. Very thankful for those guys' work, the collaboration, the pulling together of a wide swath of music. But what we're trying to do with this Redeemer Hymnal is our Church of the Redeemer congregation was a PCA congregation for a long time and then came in with the 1961 Trinity Hymnal.
Yeah.
And the Trinity Hymnal has some hearty tunes and arrangements, but it is lacking in some of the robustness that it could have in the way it puts notes and rhythms on a page, in the way it dumbs down some of the musical things that I won't belabor here. What we've sought to do with this Trinity Hymnal is to not necessarily put forth a complete psalter, because we chant the Psalms both in Anglican and plain song and in Lutheran tones in this congregation. So we have that, and we would like to do at one point a complete psalter all to itself.
Yeah.
But this hymnal project, the Redeemer Hymnal, which has been about a now going on a four-year work, is about 800 hymns or so that will be prioritized hearty texts, hearty rhythms, hearty keys that are singable above playable, mm-hmm. that are rhythmic instead of just pedantic mm-hmm. And majestic, that are probably every now and then a little more rustic than maybe smooth orchestrated versions. And so that's kind of the overall, it's going to be hard to explain. People will just have to see it. I mean, it will feel like a cousin of the Cantus. It will feel yeah. like a cousin of the Treasury of Hymns and Psalms. But what you will see is and this is why it's taken so long, is a severe focus on pastorally focusing our efforts to give the best keys, the best arrangements, the best harmonizations, and the best pairing of tune and text. In some cases, stuff that we know and love, but that's just not the most fitting in our estimation, our Redeemer Hymnal Committee's estimation. So that's kind of the drive of this hymnal. It's not the end-all be-all. It is not an abstract hymnal that's meant for some person out in the ether. It's meant for our congregation right now. So that's worth highlighting. It's not, you know, we're not making this for the denomination of unknown faces across mm-hmm. there. It's for our people. But I think it will bless our people, and hopefully what I tell our hymnal committee is, hopefully we're recovering some tunes that have been forgotten mm-hmm. and some pairings, and then maybe we'll do our part to make sure they're not forgotten in future generations.
Right. One of the ones I love is I have a little sample of the future hymnal here, Now Thank We All Our God, which we sing in our congregation to this tune here. Walk us just very briefly through how it is typically sung and how the tune is now set here with this rhythm
yeah.
of the new hymnal.
Yeah, this is my favorite of tunes, but Now Thank We All Our God is a wonderful tune by Johann Kruger. Everybody pretty much sings the same tune, but most of us grew up singing a more orchestrated version. And you may say, I didn't know that. I didn't either.
Yeah.
But it's Now Thank We All Our God, which Bach and Mendelssohn put into some instrumental works, which without getting overly nerdy, yeah. there's a lot of passing tones and a lot of almost a walking pace because the orchestra is ornamenting the melody.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what Johann Kruger wrote. He wrote a very rhythmic, very singable melody and that was very peppy in rhythm. Now thank we all our God with heart and hands and voices. I mean, that is the rhythmic version. It's the same tune. It's just more rhythmic. And I suggest we need more of those kinds of settings in our churches. Going back to the literacy discussion, where we don't have widespread music literacy,
right,
how are you going to stoke a vigor of singing? Well, you could bring out the Bach and the Mendelssohn versions of some of these hymns, and they are glorious.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do not have trained musicians in the pew and on the platform helping shepherd your people, then you would be wise to sprinkle in these more rhythmic settings,
mm-hmm,
not throwing away the other settings, but pastorally, musically pastorally, giving your congregations something that they can sing joyfully and vigorously. I think what that will do is it will fuel a love for this, and then it will allow you to go sing these other great traditions. What's happened, Yuri, is that Now Thank We All Our God has just been held on to, and then it just slows down,
right,
and people don't know what to do with it. There's so many notes. Now thank we all. And that's not thankful. You wouldn't tell your son, say, thank your mother for dinner, and they would go, thank you for my dinner. Yeah. You would say, no, you've got to have the form and the content match. And so we're just trying to sprinkle some of those out there. And what I've found, Yuri, is that there are plenty of these tunes that are hidden in plain sight of history, whether it's Now Thank We All Our God or the Old 100th,
yeah,
or A Mighty Fortress, that are rhythmic in style, and we just don't know it.
Right.
We've not been exposed to it, because I love Bach more than the next guy, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But Bach's versions, if handled by non-musicians or musicians that love hearing themselves play all of the notes,
yeah,
you will not get the vigor that is so lovely in congregational singing.
Right.
We've got to attack the literacy side, sure, but I thought this Redeemer Hymnal Project would give us an opportunity to really mine the depths of what has come before, try to put some rhythmic pairings where possible. It's going to be about 800 hymns. We will sell them here at Church of the Redeemer, very likely through Athanasius Press.
Yeah.
Folks can kind of keep up with the stuff there. I'll announce it, and I'll probably, go on a vacation for 3 weeks once it's published.
You should. This has been a very long project, but he can tell you're putting a lot of effort into it and making it not only singable, but the kind of delightful work that will stand the test of time.
Yeah, hopefully.
That'd be great. Jared, what is, I know you've been doing a lot of writing through your Substack. Tell us, our listeners, what your Substack is, where they can subscribe to your essays.
Yes, it's Musically Speaking is the title of my Substack outfit there, and it's Jared Ritchie. If you spell my name right, jaredritchie.substack.com, you'll find it. But it's a place for me to kind of sharpen my writing and encourage folks. It's kind of music literacy and hymnody and
dancing.
Yeah, just trying to cast a vision, a cheerful vision, not a grumpy vision, but a cheerful vision for robust music literacy in the church, aesthetic maturity, without finger wagging. I mean, when I do finger wag, Yuri gets onto me, so I have to, and rightly so. You know.
Jared Ritchie, thanks for joining us in this inaugural episode of Season 5, brother.
Hey, thank you for having me. I feel honored to be the tip of the spear.
Absolutely. God bless you.